Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is For the Record Program 196, and in this next half-hour segment, we're going to update Eurofascism. We're going to be reporting on the growth of fascism in various European countries, with particular emphasis not only on the ascension to power of a coalition government in Austria, including Jörg Haider, the so-called yuppie fascist, but also an analysis of the SS's and other fascist theoreticians' plans for a united Europe under fascism. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that was authored by Martin A. Lee. Martin A. Lee, as veteran listeners know, is the author of the recent and consummately important book The Beast Reawakens, published in hardcover by Little Brown, copyright 1997, and happily in late 1999, now out in paperback as well. Martin Lee wrote an op-ed column for the Los Angeles Times of Sunday, November 28th of 1999, and this op-ed column is about the growth of Eurofascism, and specifically the fascist response to globalization. In fact, that is the title of this article, or how it was entitled, by the Los Angeles Times. This is called Europe, the Fascist Response to Globalization, and it's datelined Washington, authored by Martin A. Lee. It reads in part as follows. Austria's far-right Freedom Party sent shockwaves through Europe when it won 27% of the vote in recent national elections. Jörg Haider, the Freedom Party's youthful, charismatic Führer, is now in a strong position to contend for the Austrian chancellorship, despite his penchant for expressing pro-Nazi sympathies. While Austrian officials struggled to put together a viable governing coalition, Switzerland's extreme right-wing People's Party, led by Christoph Blocher, B-L-O-C-H-E-R, scored a major electoral breakthrough, winning 23% of the vote in late October. Blocher, like Haider, is a tub-thumping, xenophobic multimillionaire who rails against immigrants, government corruption, and the European Union. Blocher caused a stir when he praised the author of a book that denied the Holocaust. Austria and Switzerland are small countries with comparatively little influence on the world stage. But if such enthusiasm for the extreme right extended across the border into Germany, it would be a matter of grave concern for the entire international community. Currently, in economically depressed eastern Germany, an alarming 15-20% of young men vote for neo-fascist parties. Quote, "To say that one-third of East German youth is now prone to the extreme right is an understatement," unquote, warns Berlin criminologist Bernd Wagner. Again quoting, "The point of no return has already been reached for many. It's growing. It's getting worse," unquote. "Neo-fascism and neo-Nazism are gaining ground in many countries, especially in Europe," unquote, says Maurice Glele and Ahanzo, A-H-A-N-H-A-N-Z-O, special rapporteur of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. Of particular concern, Glele Ahanzo noted in a recent report to the UN General Assembly, is the, quote, "increase in the power of the extreme right parties," unquote, thriving in, again quoting, "an economic and social climate characterized by fear and despair," unquote. Among the key factors fueling the far right, according to the UN report, are, quote, "the combined effects of globalization, identity crises, and social exclusion," unquote. Radical right-wing populist movements with openly fascist roots have made significant inroads into mainstream politics in several West European countries, including Belgium, where the neo-fascist Vlaams bloc outpolls all rivals with 30% of the vote in Antwerp, the second largest city. Far-right parties have also gained at least 15% nationwide in France, Italy, and Norway. While this percentage may seem inconsequential in terms of the U.S. two-party system, it can carry great weight in parliamentary balloting and determine the political makeup of government. Even when they lose elections, neo-fascists are like a toxic chemical in the water supply of the European political landscape, polluting public discourse and pressuring establishment parties to adopt extremist positions to fend off challenges from the hard right. Scapegoating foreigners and ethnic minorities, ultra-right-wing demagogues have touched a raw nerve in a tumultuous post-Cold War world still reeling from the demise of Soviet bloc communism, the reunification of Germany, global economic restructuring, and major technological change. In Western Europe today, there are 50 million poor, 18 million unemployed, and 3 million homeless, and Europe is faring much worse. Such conditions are ripe for exploitation by extreme right organizations that range from tiny splinter groups and underground terrorist cells to sizable political parties. While skinhead gangs may function as shock troops of the far right's march through Europe, leaders of the more successful, mass-based neo-fascist organizations have softened their image and tailored their message to appeal to mainstream voters. Riding the crest of a populist backlash against globalization, Far-right opportunists couple their anti-immigrant tirades with pointed criticisms of the European Union and the recent introduction of a single currency, the euro. By the way, I would add that Pat Buchanan and others in the American political landscape have a similar sort of political agenda. I would also note, before we return to this column by Martin A. Lee, that in a book that I've quoted in the past, The Thousand Years Conspiracy by Paul Winkler, copyright 1943, some of the machinations of key German industrialists and financiers, as well as political figures in the Weimar period, are analyzed at length. And while those economic machinations strengthened the hand of large corporations and wiped out the middle class and made things still tougher for the working class and poor, these particular machinations were designed on both particular agendas. Basically, they were designed to both strengthen the hand of wealthy industrialists and financiers, to strengthen the hand of the elite, while at the same time making things tougher for those underneath, and thereby paving the way for demagogues to rail against international big capital and finance capitalism, as Adolf Hitler called it, and characterizing that as Jewish as well. I would take note of the fact that the German word for power is Macht, and the European Monetary Union, as I've looked at in the past, is the realization of the theories of Friedrich Liszt, a pan-German theoretician and economist who envisioned an economically unified Europe as a vehicle for German world conquest and for unseating the United Kingdom as the top power on earth. The United Kingdom has now been succeeded by another Anglo-Saxon power, the United States, as the dominant power on earth. I would not dismiss the possibility that the European Monetary Union, which in many ways is producing a political reaction on behalf of fascism, was designed not only to cement German economic control over Europe and to give Germany a dominant position in the world, ultimately, but also to, through xenophobia and social injustice, to pave the way for fascism in other European countries as well. Again, that's a possibility that must be seriously considered under the circumstances. Returning to the Martin A. Lee article, riding the crest of a populist backlash against globalization, far-right opportunists couple their anti-immigrant tirades with pointed criticisms of the European Union and the recent introduction of a single currency, the euro. They have gotten mileage out of exploiting justifiable qualms about the European Monetary Union, which they present as an attempt by Europe's big business to adapt to the needs of the new global economic order. Full participation in the European Union required painful budgetary retrenchment by member states, which, for better or worse, relinquished authority on key fiscal matters to unelected central bankers in Frankfurt. The adoption of the euro and the globalization of financial markets in general have significantly limited the capacity of national governments to regulate their economics and redress high unemployment by adjusting their currencies and tweaking their interest rates. Not surprisingly, voter turnout among Europeans has dropped precipitously, along with public confidence in elected representatives. Disenchantment with the conventional political spectrum is heightened by the failure of erstwhile left-of-center social democratic parties to offer an alternative agenda to rigid EU policy nostrums. This, in turn, has strengthened the hands of neo-fascists and other right-wing extremists who have successfully tapped into widespread resentment of unresponsive state governments. President Bill Clinton has spoken about, quote, the inexorable logic of globalization, unquote, that no country can escape. While economically driven, this phenomenon also has far-reaching social consequences. Global commerce acts as the great homogenizer, blurring indigenous differences and smothering contrasting ethnic traits. Consequently, many Europeans are fearful of losing not only their jobs, but their cultural and national identities. Where local traditions lose influence, individuals tend to become atomized psychologically and thus more susceptible to the lures of ultranationalists who manipulate deep-seated anxieties. The much-ballyhooed new information technologies have created an environment conducive to financial speculation and the rapid growth of global commerce. Increasingly, the key players in the global economy are multinational corporations, transnational lobbies, and elite trade associations rather than popularly conscripted officials. These global forces have usurped many of the usual prerogatives of the nation-state, while also calling into question democratic notions of political power and representation. Though free markets are supposed to guarantee maximum efficiency, they have instead magnified inequalities and hastened the breakdown of certain social structures, leading to instability, mass migration, and ethnic strife. At the same time, the waning power of the nation-state has triggered a harsh, ultra-nationalist reaction, as demonstrated by the surge of support from mass-based far-right parties in several European countries. Supporters of the EU have long argued that economic integration is a crucial step toward creating a political union, which they hope will end forever the scourge of pitiless nationalism that has ravaged the continent in the past. But just the opposite seems to be happening. As economic globalization has accelerated, producing definite winners and losers, so too has the momentum of neo-fascist and right-wing extremist organizations. If anything, European integration is likely to foster the continued growth of radical right-wing parties. Burgeoning ultranationalist movements are collateral damage inflicted by unfettered globalization, which breeds the very monstrosities it purports to oppose. And the extreme right provides an alibi for globalization while revolting against it. Note this last sentence. And the extreme right provides an alibi for globalization while revolting against it. A product of democratic decay, radical right-wing populism and its current fascist manifestations, which vary from country to country, can only thrive in situations where social injustice is prevalent. Converging economic, political, and social trends suggest that increasing numbers of people in the Western democracies will become vulnerable to the appeals of neo-fascists posing as national populists offering simple solutions to complex problems. Quote, "It is becoming frighteningly evident that unspeakable evil can take the stage again," unquote, Swedish Prime Minister Göran Persson declared at a recent conference on resurgent racism and neo-fascism in Europe. The ghastly miscarriage of free market restructuring in much of the former Soviet bloc and the Third World, the abdication of the socialist left as a vehicle for discontentment in Western Europe, and the homogenizing juggernaut of transnational capitalism across the globe, all are elements of a potent witch's brew that propels mainstream governance farther and farther into the politics of resentment. Shortly before he died in 1987, Primo Levi, a survivor of Auschwitz, warned of the advent of a, quote, "a new fascism, walking on tiptoe and calling itself by other names," unquote. This new fascism is a decidedly contemporary phenomenon that looks different in many ways from its antecedents, unquote. When Adolf Hitler came to power, he took the world by surprise. Those who remain fixated on images of the fascist past and neglect the growing dangers of the present may be taken by surprise again. Indeed, and I would note that Jörg Haider is now part of a governing coalition in Austria, and what we're going to look at next is an article researched for us by a listener. This comes from the FAIR L, that is FAIR's online reporting service. FAIR stands for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. This is a FAIR media advisory, datelined February 4th of the year 2000. It's headlined, U.S. Media Downplay Fascist Ties of Austria's Haider. Haider's pro-Nazi gaffes are no aberration. And FAIR L, by the way, can be obtained by contacting FAIR, and their website is fair.org. The article reads in part, "Jörg Haider's Freedom Party's rise to power as a partner in the Austrian government has gotten a lot of coverage in the U.S. media, but there has been little recognition of it as symptomatic of a resurgence of the extreme right in Europe and of the implications this may have for European integration. When the Freedom Party won nearly a third of the vote in Austria's national elections last October, it generated front-page coverage in most European newspapers. The Times of London 10/4/99 warned that, quote, Haider's result has thrown Austrian politics into turmoil, frightened investors, and brought closer to power the largest and most radical far-right party in Europe. By contrast, the Freedom Party's electoral breakthrough elicited little more than a shrug from mainstream U.S. media, as typified by a Seattle Post-Intelligencer editorial of October 12, 1999, headlined, Europe has little to fear from this goose-stepping Austrian, unquote. The New York Times also downplayed the results of the Austrian election, referring to, quote, the seemingly unstoppable rise of Jörg Haider, unquote, in an article of December 6, 1999 by Alison Smale, quote, a rightist leader stirs tepid dissent and assent, unquote. The bland U.S. reportage represented another victory of sorts for Haider, the charismatic Porsche-driving populist who undertook a transatlantic post-election charm campaign to shore up his image, which has been tarnished by several pro-Nazi gaffes. Haider had praised Nazi SS veterans as men of character, unquote, and he called Winston Churchill the 20th century's greatest war criminal. He also said that all soldiers in World War II, regardless of which side they were on, had fought for peace and freedom. Asked about such comments, Haider, quote, made a stunning apology, unquote, at a meeting with editors of the Washington Post, which subsequently reported on November 10th of 1999, quote, "Repentance, moderation, and tolerance should be encouraged, provided they are part of an evolution anchored in sincerity and not spin," unquote. While Haider's belated apology is certainly newsworthy, U.S. media have thus far neglected to disclose pertinent facts that seriously call into question his latest PR maneuvers. True, Haider does not conform to the stereotype of a Hollywood Nazi, but a brown stain hovers over the Freedom Party, thanks in part to Haider's decision to retain as his advisor on cultural affairs Andreas Mölzer, M-O-L-Z-E-R, a fascist ideologue who until recently was publisher of the Vienna weekly Zur Zeit. This virulent racist newspaper, which Mölzer published for several years while advising Haider, ran articles raving about, quote, "the dogma of the 6 million murdered Jews," unquote, and the, quote, "epic-making economic and political successes of the great revolutionary," unquote, a reference to Adolf Hitler. Far from being gaffes, as news media often refer to his apparent verbal missteps, Haider's penchant for expressing pro-Nazi sympathies was intrinsic to his calculated attempt to build political support by catering to deep-rooted prejudice in Austrian society. For additional evidence that Haider is being disingenuous when he speaks of banishing the brown shadows, one need look no farther than his nomination of Thomas Prinzhorn, P-R-I-N-Z-H-O-R-N, to stand as the Freedom Party's top candidate in last year's parliamentary poll. A few days before the vote, Prinzhorn hysterically accused the Austrian government of giving free hormone treatments to male immigrants to boost their birth rate. But this remark didn't stop Prinzhorn from being chosen recently as co-speaker of the Austrian Parliament. As professor, Mark Mazower writes in the Manchester Guardian Weekly of 10-20-99, if Haider himself, quote, steers clear of overt racism, it is no doubt partly because things are better said in code, unquote. Added Mazower, quote, the shock value of Haider's views on history strike me as less worrying than his xenophobic approach to the present. His success may move the threshold of what is acceptable in European politics, unquote. Indeed, xenophobia and racism are far from being exclusively Austrian problems. And again, as noted here by Fair, the Austrian media have downplayed Jörg Haider's fascist sentiments and activities. I would note that in For the Record Program 28, a 3-half-hour series available from Spitfire, done in the spring of 1996, I analyzed the political rise of Jörg Haider and his true antecedents. By the way, speaking of his antecedents, an article researched for us by Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator, has some interesting things to say about those. This is from the London Independent's Weekend Review of February 5th of the year 2000. And again, this is research for us by Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator. This is by Imre Karacs, K-A-R-A-C-S, and it's called Profile, Jörg Haider, A Man for All Seasons. And skipping down, there's some discussion of Jörg Haider's antecedents. Both his parents were passionate National Socialists, joining the party in the early 1930s when you could still get into trouble in Austria for wearing a brown shirt. Their affiliation seemed to pay off for a while. Mr. Haider's father, a cobbler, was entrusted with small but uplifting responsibilities in the party before joining the Wehrmacht. His mother became a respected member of Hitler's League of German Maidens. And ultimately, Haider's financial independence came from a very curious source, a great-uncle whom he hardly knew, and one wonders just who that great-uncle might have been. One wonders whether perhaps that great-uncle was in fact Odessa or the Bormann Group or some similar element of the Underground Reich. That great-uncle bequeathed him an estate. Reading about this in the same article from the London Independent of February 5th of this year, in 1986 was also the year when Mr. Haider was blessed with fortune. A great-uncle he hardly knew bequeathed him the Bear Valley estate in Carinthia. The property was tainted. The family had purchased it for a pittance in the late 1930s from a Jewish professor fleeing the Holocaust. But for Mr. Haider, it was a godsend. He would never have to worry again about the price of fast cars and lift passes. And again, one wonders whether perhaps that great-uncle was the Bormann Group or something similar to that, Odessa, or some similar element of the Underground Reich. Certainly a possibility that should not be too readily dismissed. Haider, by the way, has continued to demonstrate the same sorts of political instincts which got him branded the yuppie fascist. No sooner did he take power or assume power as part of this coalition government than he began to show some of his reactionary fascist and Nazi inclinations. The following is from the New York Times of Monday, February 7th of the year 2000, an article by Roger Cohen, datelined Berlin, February 6th, headlined, Haider opens old wound over Germans' Czechs ousted. Jörg Haider, the rightist leader whose Freedom Party is part of the new Austrian government, said today that ethnic Germans expelled from what was Czechoslovakia at the end of World War II should be entitled to the same compensation as Austrian Jews persecuted by the Nazis. The statement reopened an old, often suppressed grievance in the German-speaking world. It centers on the expulsion from their homes or imprisonment in the Soviet Union of millions of Germans in the aftermath of Hitler's war and the lack of compensation for their losses or suffering. The remarks of the Freedom Party leader seemed certain to intensify international unease over Mr. Haider, whose intermittently revisionist views have included statements later apologized for praising aspects of Hitler's rule. By equating the suffering of the Sudeten Germans with Jewish victims of the Holocaust just a few days after signing a declaration saying that, quote, the crimes of the Holocaust are without precedent in history, unquote, Mr. Haider appeared likely to heighten international concern that his word is worth little or nothing. Indeed, I think that is a valid concern. And I would note that the Vertriebene groups, or the Bund der Vertriebene, the expellees groups in Germany, have very close connections not only to the German establishment, but also to the post-war elements of the SS. And speaking of post-war elements of the SS, one of the theoretical pillars of SS thinking for post-war Europe was a unified Europe under fascism. And the German chauvinism in this unified fascist Europe would be removed. Now, I would note that in For the Record Program 187, I noted that post-war fascist theoreticians such as Francis Parker Yockey and also Sir Oswald Mosley, head of the British European of Fascists, envisioned a united post-war Europe under fascism as a vehicle for destroying the influence of not only the former Soviet Union, but also the United States as well. Yockey and Mosley, in turn, were simply echoing a plan for a post-war united fascist Europe that had originally been devised by the SS. We're going to take a look at that from a very important recent book. That book is called Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. That book was authored by Kevin Coogan, published in softcover by Otano Media, copyright 1999, and you can find Otano Media at otanomedia.org. Now, the two SS theoreticians who helped to draw up plans for a united post-war Europe under fascism were a fellow named Alfred Franke Gritsch and also a guy named Werner Best. Kevin Coogan writes about this as follows in Dreamer of the Day. It is Franke Gritsch's activity at the end of, by the way, it's capital F-R-A-N-K-E hyphen capital G-R-I-C-K-S-C-H. It is Franke Gritsch's activity at the end of World War II, however, that concerns us most. Imagine Berlin in April of 1945. The thunder of continual Soviet artillery bombardment is relentless. The Thousand-Year Reich is in ruins. Yet Franke Gritsch, by that time head of the personnel section of Himmler's RSHA, the Reich Security Main Office, Nazi Germany's CIA, spent the last days of the war preparing a blueprint for a post-war fascist Europe, which he titled the German Freedom Movement, or Popular Movement. Drafted on April 3, 1945, the German Freedom Movement demanded a Nazi party purge. Franke Gritsch then demanded that Germany be preserved, quote, from reversion to the obsolete concept of capitalism, and I would note the anti-capitalist tone of many of the current Euro-fascists, although fascism is ultimately, in many ways, the ultimate manifestation of capitalism. I would note that it often, and Hitler did this too, it often maintains an overtly or superficially anti-capitalist stance. Skipping down, more about SS official Alfred Franke Gritsch's plans for a post-war united Europe under fascism. The German Freedom Movement outlined a new pan-European foreign policy program which included a 12-point European peace settlement, unquote, and the creation of a new sworn European community, unquote, of peoples who would retain their, quote, individual existence, unquote, and right, quote, freely to form their own political organization, unquote. A, quote, European arbitration system, unquote, would also be created to secure some form of voluntary allegiance to a Germanic Reich, unquote. One scholar aptly described Franke Gritsch's plan for a new Europe as being based on the call of the blood, unquote, but tempered by the introduction of a federal system and excluding any claim to sole leadership by Germany, unquote. Superficially in many ways like the EU. Continuing, 3 years before Francis Parker Yockey's Imperium, the German freedom movement envisioned a post-Hitler Europe freed from the biological exaltation of the German race. A similar concept had been developed by a top clique of SS technicians whose ranks included SS Brigadier General Franz Alfred Sieks. An intimate of Heydrich, Sieks presided over a propaganda empire that included the RSHA's Amt 7, or Bureau 7, which was in charge of ideological research. Sieks was also involved in SS planning for the invasion of England and would have been in charge of all police action, unquote, during the occupation. After Sieks became head of the German Foreign Policy Institute, he actively promoted the idea of a united Europe through books like Europe's Civil Wars and the Present War of Unification in Europe, Tradition and Future. As the fighting of the East grew desperate, Sieks escalated his pan-European propaganda throughout the occupied territories. SS Lieutenant General Werner Best was another strong advocate of pan-European fascism. As noted in For the Record Program 187, again relying on the consummately important text by Kevin Coogan, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, from which I just quoted, post-war fascist theoreticians such as the very important Francis Parker Yockey, little known but very important, and Sir Oswald Mosley, head of the British European of Fascists, echoed the views of SS theoreticians like Franke Grietsch, Franz Alfred Sieks, and Werner Best for a post-war united Europe under fascism. Jürg Haider has no sooner assumed power in Europe than, as I indicated, he began espousing the cause of the Vertriebene groups in Germany. He also has made a very controversial decision to visit Italy and to begin associating with Umberto Bossi of Italy's Northern League. That is a proto-fascist organization that seeks to separate the economically stronger northern part of Italy from the southern part and to unite it with the Tyrol and Germany and Austria. Information about this from the Financial Times of Europe of Wednesday, February 9th of the year 2000. When I say united, I mean economically, not politically. This is an article by James Blitz in Rome. It's headlined, Italy Split After Haider Agrees to Visit Friuli. It reads in part as follows. Italy's northeastern region of Friuli Venezia Giulia has been thrown into confusion by the possibility that Jürg Haider, the leader of the Austrian Freedom Party, could soon visit the area. Skipping down, Friuli Venezia Giulia, whose capital is Trieste, is one of Italy's smallest regions. A melting pot of rival cultures and traditions, it has long had strong political and trading links with neighboring Austria and Slovenia. Italy's Northern League, the separatist movement led by Umberto Bossi, plays a powerful role in local politics and has developed links with Mr. Haider's party. Last week, the regional council issued a strong statement in support of Mr. Haider, claiming that he had, quote, only occasionally expressed appreciation of the Third Reich, unquote, and that he had later apologized for such comments. And the council also invited him to visit the area. I would also note that someone who has been a close political ally of Umberto Bossi's in Italy, Gianfranco Fini of the Alleanza Nazionale, the AN, the final reincarnation and the successor to Mussolini's fascist organization, his original fascisti, there is a possibility that the AN may also become part of a coalition in Italy. The Financial Times of London of Friday, February 18th of the year 2000 reported on this, also by James Blitz in Rome, headlined, Schroeder's warning on fascists irks Italy. And skipping down, we read, Italian officials said Italy's far-right National Alliance, or AN, led by Gianfranco Fini, would probably enter the government if the center-right were to win the next general election. They noted that Mr. Fini had gone to some lengths in recent years to distance AN from its neo-fascist parent party, the Italian Social Movement. And note again in the article by Martin Lee with which we began this program, there was a warning by Primo Levi to be careful of a new fascism walking on tiptoe and calling itself something else. That concludes this program. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.